This is the fifth day of this January 2018 Rohatsu seven-day session. We'll return to our text of the teachings of Korean Zen master Kusan Sunim from the book The Way of Korean Zen. He says, "Assembly of monks, it is true that these days you are exerting much effort in your practice of meditation. However, I would like to add a few words for your benefit. Of the 90 days of this winter retreat, already half have passed, for today we have reached the midpoint of the meditation season, and only 45 days are now left." I think we read earlier that he would give what we would call teisho, only every 2 weeks. "Every day time flows on urgently like water. Even though it may seem that there are certain enjoyments in daily life, actually we are just like fish in a pool whose water is constantly being drained away." We could say that all of life is a practice of dying. We're all born with a terminal illness. "Likewise, not only you monks gathered here, but all sentient beings are traveling the path that only leads to death. As each day passes, your lifespan decreases by 1 day. And as each hour passes, it decreases by 1 hour. Just listen to this clock. With every tick, the second hand moves, pauses, and moves on again. This itself can immediately be taken as a dharma lecture of the Buddha. Therefore, the demon of transiency is propelling us toward death every moment. If you do not realize the truth of the unborn, then when the time of death suddenly arrives, you will find yourself moaning in illness. Even though nobody wants to die, every one of us will inevitably perish. Is there anyone here among you whose body is not a potential corpse? If there is, then speak out. Furthermore, should we live solely for the benefit of this potential corpse? Or would it be better to live in order to awaken to the truth of the unborn? When you are finally moaning in illness, then you may have regrets at not having diligently practiced while alive. But at that time, such regrets will be in vain. Therefore, why do you not practice now? Why do you just continue to play around?" The unborn is a Zen term that we hear from the masters, some more than others. The Japanese Zen master Bankei, that was his main teaching, was to realize the unborn, that which is beyond life and death, birth and death. The unborn is this true mind of ours. It's beyond change. "The mind is just like the moon rising behind a mass of clouds. It seems dim because its brightness, like the brightness of the moon, is obscured and cannot shine forth. However, if the mind is purified, a Buddha will appear." That is, Buddha always means, unless it's referring to the historical person, Shakyamuni Buddha, Buddha always means Buddha nature, enlightened one, which we all are, and our true nature. He continues, keep your koan bright and do not let it darken. Everything else can be left aside, but the koan should be considered as your own life. You must try to investigate it like an old mouse entering a cow horn. And then I'll just sort of summarize. He says that in some countries, when people want to catch a mouse, they'll put a little fragrant oil in the pointed end of a horn and place it near the mouse's hole. The mouse is attracted, of course, by the smell and crawls into the horn and gets stuck at the very end. And then he makes the point that in order to taste the oil, the foolish mouse has no fear of death and without any hesitation crawls right to the end of the horn. When even a mouse can be as brave as this in order to get what it desires, shouldn't human beings put forth a similar determination of mind in order to resolve the great matter of birth and death and to realize the great truth of the universe? Shouldn't human beings cease to be preoccupied with this body and one time exert themselves in order to awaken? You should practice with the same urgency as a person with a parched throat thinking of water. If you practice like this for some time, you will reach a point where the mind has nowhere left to go. At that moment, thoughts are absent and all delusive thinking comes to a complete halt. At such a time, the mass of questioning alone appears brilliantly before your eyes. I remember hearing Roshi Kaplow read this reaching this point where thoughts are exhausted, gone, and wondering how that could ever happen when it seems that they are just endless, these thoughts. But it can, especially in Sesshin. Have the ability to reach that state where the mind becomes completely empty. Now your practice may actually seem easy, but you should be most careful, since this is a very crucial moment. Throughout beginningless eons, you have been transmigrating through the suffering ocean of birth and death. Now, for one time, the mass of questioning is clear and awakening is very close by. It is as though it were screened off by a single sheet of white paper. I know that some people kind of check out when he talks about previous lives and successive lives. But he is saying things as they are. And it's a shame that one can't countenance successive lives, rebirth, because to do so opens up a whole new source of motivation. If we acknowledge that this is This is not our last life, that death is not an ending, birth is not a beginning, then this can be very mobilizing. You must be determined to pass over this crucial step. Otherwise, if you let it go by, the koan will gradually lose its vividness. Therefore, do not waste this opportunity. Now he's talking about very, very advanced state. At this time, you will automatically forget to even sleep or eat. To not let this opportunity slip by requires true wisdom. So don't waste it. Be as resolute as the Buddha when he sat for 7 days uninterruptedly. Here too, the idea of forgetting to even sleep or eat may seem so far-fetched to people, and they may make the mistake of thinking that this would take decades of practice. But it doesn't. That's the whole point of Sesshin. It is so intense. We're doing so much sitting with so much support from others that we can accelerate what it would otherwise take years. Roshi Kepler used to quote Yasutani Roshi as saying, one can, in a strong 7-day sesshin, accomplish what it would take you 3 years on your own. He continues, throughout beginningless eons, the way has been obscured by the great weight and depth of defilements. Defilements is one of these classic Buddhist words. It took me a while to warm up to it. Many years ago, it's I don't know, something unsavory about the word defilements, but it's a word you often run across in Buddhist texts. It, maybe for some people it'd be better to talk about afflictions, our habit forces, all the forms of greed and hatred and delusion. He says, exactly how heavy and deep are these defilements? They are as heavy as the earth and as deep as the ocean. Defilements are actually the habitual tendencies you have acquired since beginningless time. Since they are so deeply ingrained within you and weigh you down so greatly, how can you not see the need to practice with the utmost diligence? The defilements are like clouds covering the sun. Although the sun shines brightly behind the clouds, its brightness cannot be seen. Only when the clouds disperse will its brilliance be clearly apparent. Here, too, I think it takes, for most of us, it takes years of practice to realize the layers and layers of afflictions that we have built up. So it is that if we can just get a good run of sesshins or just daily practice, enough to take the measure of what we're up against, then I think often it's just that'll be enough to not want to quit. Now, if you really want to unearth a precious gem from the mud and stones of defilements, you should think of how snow and ice harden and melt. Recently, there has been much snow here. Now it has packed and hardened on the ground and will not melt very quickly. Just look. The snow is delivering an unsurpassable discourse on Dharma. For to dissolve the defilements and discover your true nature is similar to the melting of the snow. In order for it to melt, it must be exposed to the sun. Thereupon it turns into water, which you can then use for drinking, washing, and so forth. Imagine how long it would take to melt if it were only exposed to the sun for one day and then allowed to harden again over the following 10 cold days. So I'm reminded that this he's speaking from the forest of Korea, the mountain forest of Korea, where they probably go longer than we have been going lately without sun. And maybe it's colder there. I bet it is colder there. We went through a pretty brutal cold stretch of cold just before Sesshin. Now we're seeing the opposite for now. So on a day like this, here at Chapin Mill, the sun is not out, but things are all melting. But this is what is commonly called the January thaw, which is usually a couple days in January where the temperatures sort of go haywire very briefly. It is similar when you try to practice meditation. If you practice hard for one day but then relax and enjoy yourselves during the next 10 days, how will the hardened crust of the afflictions ever melt? This is what is so demanding about practice, and even just in Sesshin, just keeping it going for a week, is this this unrelenting effort that is called for. We can keep it up for a while, make a strong effort, lay it all down, and then there's a break, a rest period, a meal, and then we have to continue. Even in the rest period and the break, we have to continue it. It's that persistence that demands so much of us. We want to work like this. You work like mad, and then you can rest for a while, and you can, but then there's a little backsliding if you do. By rest, I don't mean that you can't take a nap. I just mean to let the mind go, not to keep the mind on the practice. Of course, anyone can do that. It's your sesshin. But then pay a little price for it. You know, it's earlier in the week we heard Kusan Sunim say it's both the hardest and the easiest thing to do, this practice. Well, we know what's hard about it, but let's remember that really all it involves is a shift of attention. It's not like we're carrying rocks. It's when we notice that the mind has wandered, then we just flick the mind's eye back to the practice. That doesn't really take a lot of energy. It's like, you're told to keep your eyes fixed on an ant on the floor, and you watch this little ant, and then next thing you know, your eye has wandered off. All you have to do is flick your eye back to the ant. It's the same with practice. It's just where we direct our attention, the aim, the direction of our attention. Now, of course, if we are in love with our thoughts, then we won't be so eager to leave them. But actually, it doesn't take a lot of effort. It's just turning one's attention back, redirecting the attention. And then once it's back on the practice, then always trying to get more and more deeply absorbed in the practice. So it's really two steps, two measures in a way, is how fast you're willing, when you notice your mind is wandering, how fast you're willing to get back to the practice, and then how thoroughly you can manage to get concentrated on the practice. He continues, even in the midst of the utmost quiescence, you should never let the koan fade. For if at such times it remains bright and vivid, then great awakening will draw nearer. When coming, the koan should be coming. When going, the koan should be going. While eating, the koan should be eating. And even while defecating, it should be the koan that defecates. In other words, non-separation. If you practice in such a way, then great awakening will certainly be closer. Therefore, do not just idly enjoy yourselves to no purpose. Carefully and earnestly investigate the living word, the koan. You know, if we had to sustain this for 90 days, then we could see how tempting it would be to take breaks with the mind. But it's just 7 days. In fact, just 3 left. Can we recognize that 3 days of this kind of effort does not require superhuman effort? It says, it is possible that someone might appear on the outside to be rather simple and even foolish. He may seem to have no courage, to be overly compliant and slow-witted. However, inside he may be wielding a mighty sword. Similarly, when confronting circumstances, on the outside you should appear to deal with them softly and compliantly, yet inside your mind should be as sharp as a mighty sword. A person who can act in such a way has truly built up a sound practice. Roshi Kapo used to say this from Japan. He said in Japan they would say that the ideal Zen person is soft and pliable on the outside and like iron on the inside, meaning that in the daily coming and going and interacting with people, such a person has a flexible, adaptive quality, not setting herself or himself up against others, not getting into unnecessary disputes or stubbornness, but finding a way to, like clouds in water, to accommodate to other people and other circumstances. And then yet someone who's with long training is extremely strong on the inside, so-called inside, outside. I think it's the two, there's a causal connection. If you have forged a strong mind and a strong will, then you know that you feel free to adapt to others and to be accommodating. It's people without that kind of inner strength who seem to feel they have to be hard and unyielding in situations. He says, likewise, you should try to be harmonious. You should learn to like and get on well with one another, and to do things for other people instead of yourself. But if you behave in a way that is contrary to the well-being and interests of others, then you will only create conflict. He continues with this, it is important to be gentle and not to go against the wishes of others. Even go out of your way to be helpful to other people. In this way, you will amass the noblest of virtues. Meekness is another quality that should be cultivated. Instead of forcing yourselves on others, you should learn to flexibly adapt yourselves to their needs. You should listen well to what they say and offer to help them in whatever work they are doing. In this way, you will find contentment and happiness. There's the point. You're not doing it just for others. That we ourselves acquire this contentment and well-being when we can harmoniously function with others. You know, he's saying you should, but these are natural fruits of sustained Zen practice. This is how people become. So much depends on how the person is at the outset of practice. If someone is very rough, argumentative, or hard sense of self, then even years later there still may be that tendency, but it will have been softened for sure. The wonderful, wonderful thing about Zen practice is we don't have to lay out goals, really, and how to refine our personality. It will happen. It's just all comes out of the practice. We recite this before Teisho, upholding the precepts, repentance and giving, the countless good deeds, the way of right living, all come from Zazen. Just to diligently, persistently do this practice day in and day out will change one's personality and character for the better. We don't have to think about it. Finally, he says, you must learn to be patient. That's another fruit of long sitting, is patience. You need to be able to forbear hardships, endure difficulties, and undertake what is arduous. While practicing, you are liable to encounter difficult periods. It is important not to give up at such times, but to bear through them diligently. In this way, the strength of forbearance will grow within you, and in the end, you will become accomplished sages. Patience is one of the most obvious fruits of practice. I always say to people, if you're not patient when you begin practice, you'll either develop it, you'll develop that patience, or you'll quit. You can't do it for a long time and not become more patient. Here he offers a personal account, first-person account, of overcoming serious illness. I thought I would read this, especially in light of how much illness there is in this sesshin. It's all too easy to become preoccupied with one's illness. Well, I'll just let this account speak for itself. This was the year in which he became a monk, 1938. He put a lot of effort into practice. I'll just kind of summarize it. He had become a friend with a monk called Paksan Sunim, a very serious meditator. Even while walking, he would keep his eyes half closed and never look around him. That's a true friend. Someone who in training is not drawing you into idle conversation all the time, but has the ability to maintain that kind of discipline. So the two of them decided to leave Songguangsa, the temple, and to continue their practice. And then he had to make a decision. His teacher's teacher asked him to stay, and his companion, Paksan, decided to leave. He wanted to go with him, but he felt he needed to oblige his teacher's teacher. And so Paksan left alone. But then he changed his mind. That is, Kusan Sunim changed his mind and put on his backpack and left to try to catch up with Paksan. He had to go about 30 kilometers, roughly 20 miles. He walked steadily during the afternoon, but he still was short of his goal. So he decided to spend the night in a nearby village, and he began to come down with illness. The next morning, after the villagers had given me something to eat, I nevertheless continued on my way in spite of the illness. However, my body was racked with pain, and with much difficulty, it took me the entire morning to cover the remaining distance. I finally reached the temple at midday. I met Paksan at the gate. He welcomed me inside. Then after eating lunch, I had to lie down because of the pain my body was still causing me. And then he rested for the rest of the afternoon. But then it started raining. We were unable to go out anyway. And his illness persisted through the night into the following morning. The next morning, the rain had stopped, but he still felt too sick to continue. This is nice. Shortly, a note came to us from the temple administration announcing that the rain had stopped. No, I'm not sure you understand. This obviously meant that the monks in the temple thought it was time for us to leave. After discussing this matter with Paksan, we realized that we had no choice but to go. So he was reluctant to set off in that condition. But his friend said, no, they want us to go, we got to go. He then mentions that things were different then. He said, nowadays, if a meditating monk wishes to stay on an extra day because he was too sick to travel, the temple would not object. But in those days, it was different. So then he considered his situation. He said, for more than a day I'd been literally moaning in illness. My whole body, from the top of my head to the soles of my feet, was in pain. However, I thought, a monk practices in order to attain liberation from birth and death and should not be upset by physical pain. And in reality, where was this pain that had been causing me such suffering? Where was it located? In this way, I carefully searched throughout my body for the place of illness. I suddenly realized there was no single place where any pain was located. Although I had scrutinized my entire body from head to toe, I could find no particular pain anywhere. Thereupon, I was immediately cured. It's hard to explain something like this, But it's not that unusual in the texts that we hear in Taisho of these monks who become masters, how they face a health crisis, and they're sometimes even near death. And what they do is, rather than looking on and on for still other, more different medications or things, they finally, in desperation, they just sit upright as best they can and just turn it all over to the practice they're working on. And then we see these kinds of abrupt cures. It's a reminder, especially when it happens to you yourself, of the power of mind. There's a verse in the Mumonkan. Rather than giving relief to the body, give relief to the mind. When body and mind are both set free, one is relieved of all suffering. It all rests on the mind. It doesn't exclude physical, sensible physical things to do, but ultimately, it's the mind that carries the day. Which really means one's faith and one's practice. That's what it means. And then he just summarizes, this account illustrates how important it is for a meditator to maintain a firm hold on his mind. This is the duty of every cultivator of the way. The mind is as wily as a fox and as mischievous as a goblin. If we just let it be, it will give rise to all kinds of different thoughts. One should not allow this to happen. Instead, if we make a firm decision in our minds, all delusive thoughts can be washed away. In this way, those of us who claim to practice meditation should keenly poise our minds like a very sharp dagger. Thus should we bear ourselves with wisdom. He continues, to succeed in the practice of meditation, you must raise the final resolve. So what is this final resolve? It is true that all of you here have left your families with a resolve to cultivate your minds. But now you carry the backpack of a monk and spend your lives in the meditation hall. But this is just an ordinary resolve. That is, the monastic commitment. It is not what is meant by the final resolve. That's something. The final resolve, as we hear, is something that lay people as well as monks can take. The final resolve is to completely sever all concerns about life and death, so that you no longer care whether you live or die. With such a resolve, a meditator just sticks the two words life and death to his forehead and, grinding his teeth, perseveres with his practice. When so determined, he casts aside the body just as he would throw a stone into the gutter. Why is it necessary to exert such effort? Because the Buddhas and patriarchs of the past, as well as the wise teachers of today, have all said the same thing, namely, every being is intrinsically a Buddha. But reflecting on yourselves now, do you have the confidence to truly say that you are a noble and enlightened Buddha, an enlightened one? Yeah, it's these last days of Sesshin where we really are up against the crucible of faith. How much faith do we have? It means faith in oneself, as he was just saying, faith that each one of us lacks nothing. We have just boundless wisdom and compassion. All wisdom is within us. We don't need something from anyone else to realize this mind. But then in terms of just the nitty-gritty of actual practice, it all becomes faith in the practice we're working on. Yes, practice in a larger sense of this method, Zazen, but then faith in the practice we're working on, the breath or the koan, shikantaza, whatever it is we're doing. That's what it all comes down to now in this last stage of Sesshin. How much faith do you have in the practice you're working on versus your thoughts? There it is. That's what determines what happens from here on out. If you still have faith in your thoughts, that there's something there that's going to help you or offer relief, then you're hindering yourself. You have to be willing to let go of thoughts and put everything into the practice we're working on. Stop now and recite the four vows. All beings without number,
I bow to liberate endless blind matter, and I bow to uproot Dharma gates beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I bow to attain all beings without number. I bow to liberate endless blind passions. I bow to uproot Dharma gates beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I bow to attain all beings without number. I bow to liberate endless blind passions. I bow to uproot Dharma gates beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I bow to attain.